You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works by Rudolf Steiner, number 314, entitled Physiology and Healing, Treatment, Therapy, and Hygiene, translated by Anna Moyes. This is part two of this set of lectures. They are overall entitled Anthroposophical Basis for the Practice of Medicine. This is lecture five in the book, given in Stuttgart on the 26th of October, 1922. You'll have to excuse me a little today, for I have only just arrived, with an exhausting tour behind me, and basically will probably not be able to give a proper talk until tomorrow. I would, however, like to give a kind of introduction today to the lectures I'll be giving here. It was not my original intention to speak at this medical event, for in my opinion, ideas for medicine and natural scientific thinking that result from the anthroposophical method of investigation should be taken up by people who are qualified in the field concerned. With any findings made in anthroposophical spiritual investigation relating to medicine, and for example also to physiology, it is only possible to make suggestions which must then be taken further empirically. It needs this empirical work to form a valid, convincing opinion about the matter in question, an opinion of the kind needed in the field of therapy. If I now give these few lectures, after all, it is at the special request of our physicians here, and I'll endeavor to touch on the particular aspects in these days that enable the actual anthroposophical element to cast its light on the field of medicine. I will attempt to show that the opinion we can gain concerning the human being, both in sickness and in health, can be enriched and deepened with the anthroposophical view. In this introduction, I may perhaps draw your attention to how this anthroposophical view should really be taken today, that is, in the historical present. People easily confuse the discipline here called anthroposophy with earlier traditional ways of considering humanity. I won't say a word about them, nor criticize them, though it has to be said that the views I represent have a very different basis than the mystical, theosophical, Gnostic, etc. views that have become traditional in the course of human history. I only have to stress the main point to show clearly and radically the difference between the views represented here and those earlier ones. Those earlier views are wholly based on human thinking at a time when there was as yet no natural science in our sense. And my views are based on the fact that they are arising at a time when natural science has been developed and has even achieved a certain, if only temporary, perfection. We must always think of this when we want to grasp the whole meaning of the discussions, a meaning present in anything that can be said and explored from the anthroposophical point of view in the many different branches of human knowledge and skill. You all know, I need not go into detail, that in those earlier days, when the view of the supersensible world was free from natural science, to our way of thinking, of course, there were also many supersensible views in medicine, views about the human being that do not arise in the way which we really consider to be a matter of course in empirical science today. We need only go back to the time of Galen, approximately, and if sufficiently open-minded, we will everywhere find views on the human being that provided the basis also for medical thinking. Those views, considering the human form, the form of the organs, and the functions of the human being, did in their way connect the things which we today gain in empiricism with thoughts on supersensible elements. They seem, as one will easily think, to have placed the supersensible in human nature. But for them it was bound up with human nature, the way colors, forms, and inorganic forces are bound up with things in the outside world. Only prejudiced people will today speak of those past times in the development of human medicine, as if views were childlike compared to modern ones. Historical texts are as inadequate as possible, particularly in this respect. And for someone who enters a little into the historical evolution of humanity and does not take the point of view that perfection has now been achieved and all that went before was foolishness, it will, of course, be clear that our present level is again only relative, and we certainly must not merely look down on earlier times, as is evident even when we look at the successes. Yet no one, irrespective of the approach he may be using to any branch of modern science, should fail to recognize the achievements of science in more recent times. If a way of looking at the human being in sickness and health that is in accord with the spirit, to use the Goethean term, is to find any kind of confirmation today, it must not work against natural scientific research, but solely with natural scientific research. You will therefore not expect me to enter into any kind of polemics about natural scientific views. Quite the contrary. I would stress from the beginning that this cannot be the case for a quite specific reason, on principle. You see, looking back at those earlier views in medicine, we find that although they were not as foolish as some might think today, they did lack the element which we have gained from natural science today. The reason why it was lacking was simply that human powers of perception were not at all such in those earlier times that things could be seen as we see them today, in an empiricism based on the senses and given more power by instruments. The insights we gain through empiricism today are something of which we may say, the physician of old, forgive me for putting it like this, I might just as well say the physiologist or biologist of old, saw something that was very different from what people see today. We could actually speak of the medical mind having a different orientation in those earlier times that really came to a radical end with Galen. Galen did not see his four elements of the human organism, black and yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, the way people see them today. He saw things differently, in such a way that, as he described it, and if one understands his words, we do not usually understand them as they have come down from earlier times. It's like a mist today. He saw this mist as a reality, not seeing phlegm as we know it today in his phlegm, in quotes, but something that was not only fluid, filled with life, but also fluid filled with soul. That is what he saw. He would see it as clearly as when we say it is something red or blue. He thus saw something for which the modern scientific mind is no longer organized. On the other hand, he did not see the things that we really have in mind scientifically today. One might say, let us assume, someone whose eye is not all that abnormal is using glasses, and this means clearer outlines than he would perceive normally. And with modern empiricism, things that were blurred in the past, but seen in mind and soul, have vanished, and instead we have the sharp outlines of present-day empiricism. People did not have those in earlier times. They would therefore also treat the sick out of a kind of instinct, which, by the way, was bound up with powerful development of human compassion. Physicians of old always entered into the patient's sickness with feeling, wearing them down at times. They treated them out of this, and they did not see the sharp contours we have with our empiricism based on the senses today. The process leading to this empiricism has its foundations in human evolution, and because of this we cannot simply get rid of it and go back to the old ways. We would need to acquire some kind of atavistic abilities to have the kind of thing naturally which the people of old had in all spheres, including the medical. Today we grow into our civilization simply because of the nature of our primary school education. I won't even mention higher education. And it is therefore impossible for us to see what people saw in the past. We cannot do so. If we were able to see things the way the people of old did, we would be thought to be psychopaths today. Not very bad ones, but at least not quite as we should be. And that is not entirely wrong. For everything of an elemental nature today, well, let's call it clairvoyance, has something psychopathic about it. We have to be clear about that. But what we can do is to develop the inner capacities that otherwise lie dormant in the soul, and so work our way up to seeing the spiritual element in the soul, just as the eye, EYE, has worked its way up in the course of phylogenetic evolution, from seeing things blurred to seeing sharp contours. Today we are able to develop powers of a seeing mind. I have described the development of a seeing mind in Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and in other books I have written. When people develop such powers, they will at first see a world which they did not see before, but one which encompasses a kind of spiritual cosmos beyond the cosmos we perceive with the senses today, and the discoveries made and calculated in astronomy. A cosmos is added to the one we perceive through the senses, which is wholly subject to natural laws. This is a spiritual cosmos. If we then pursue the things we can find in the spiritual cosmos, we also find the human being in it. We grasp a spiritual universe filled with soul. And as part of this universe filled with spirit and soul, we find the human being. In ordinary natural science, we start with the simplest creature, or the simplest form of life, the cell, and then move up to complex elements, ascending from something which closely resembles simple matter that is physically differentiated, to the highly complex human organism. Working in a serious way with the science of the spirit, we start at the other end, as it were. We go down from grasping the spiritual in the universe and see this as the complex form. We see the cell as the simplest thing in the organism. From the spiritual scientific point of view, the universe is most complex, and where otherwise we make our own elements of insight complex to go from the cell to the human being, we now simplify the things given in the cosmos more and more, and this brings us to the human being. We take the opposite route, that is, we start from a point that is the polar opposite. Yet when we work with the science of the spirit today, we do not initially and basically come to the regions that lie within our present-day evidence-based empiricism, for instance. I must really take care that no misunderstanding arises in these fundamental points. So I have to ask you to forgive me for being pedantic about some terms. It would be a massive error if someone were to think that it is pointless to apply evidence-based empiricism in physiology, in biology. What need is there of specialist knowledge? You develop spiritual abilities, look into the spiritual world, and gain a view of the human being in sickness and health, establishing a spiritual medicine, as it were. Some people do this, but they gain nothing from it, except perhaps that they complain about empirical medicine, but are in that case complaining about something they know nothing about. So there can be no question of drawing a line against the usual evidence-based empirical science, and establishing a science of the spirit out of some cloud cuckoo land. That is not our attitude to the empirical sciences, that is, science called empirical today, though I prefer to call it evidence-based empirical science. That is not at all the case. Doing spiritual scientific investigations, you will not, for example, arrive at the same result as when you work with a microscope. You may certainly call someone a charlatan who wants to make you think that one will find the same through the science of the spirit as one does under the microscope, for that is not how it is. The things arising from empirical studies in the present-day sense are there. To make science complete in any particular field, also in terms of spiritual scientific anthroposophy, it is not permissible to clear the evidence-based empirical findings out of the way, for we must indeed take them into account. Someone who is an expert, if I may use that term, in anthroposophical spiritual science, will never find anything other than that to work in that science. We are even more obliged to consider evidence-based empirical findings and the phenomena of the world. The science of the spirit initially provides guidelines for empirical research, directives, which show that when something is in a particular location in the organism, we must also consider the nature of that location. Some will say that a cell is a cell, and that empirical observation must also show the distinctions between cells, be they liver cells or brain cells. But that is definitely not the case. You see, when I pass a bench on a walk, I take at 9 in the morning, there are two people sitting on it side by side. I look at them, form an opinion about various aspects relating to them. At 3 in the afternoon, I walk that way again, and the two people are again sitting there. Well, the empirical facts are at first sight exactly the same in what I see, apart from subtle differences. But it may be that one of those people has continued to sit there for the 6 hours, and the other went away immediately after I walked past, has only just returned, and went a long way in between. This will greatly change the picture, and has nothing to do with the facts initially presented to my senses. The same facts present at 9 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. But the evidence of the senses must be judged in its context and in its elements. And there it is very much a matter of understanding, for instance, in how far a liver cell has to be judged in a completely different way from a brain cell, let's say, or a blood cell. Only if it is correct, for example, that there was one original germ cell which was fertilized, and the whole organism can be explained as due to simple division of that germ cell, only if that were the case could we simply treat the liver cell in the same way as the brain cell and base ourselves wholly on the evidence of our senses. But if it were not the case, for instance, because compared to a brain cell, a cell in the liver relates differently to forces outside the human being, outside the human skin, simply because of its location, we cannot simply consider what happens in continuation of the division and the resulting location, but have to relate the brain cell to the universe in a totally different way than we do the liver cell. When someone looks at a magnetic needle and finds that it points from south to north, north to south, and then insists that the forces responsible for this are in the needle itself, one would very definitely not call him a physicist today. As a physicist, one relates the magnetic needle to something called the Earth's magnetism. People may have all kinds of theories, but the direction of a magnetic needle cannot be ascribed to forces within it. The magnetic needle must be related to the universe. When someone looks at the organic sphere, relationships to the universe are, as a rule, extraordinarily subordinate to him, But if it were to be the case that the liver, for instance, would have a totally different relationship to powers of the universe that are outside the human being than the brain, we would not be able to arrive at any kind of explanation for the human being by today's route of factual empiricism. In that case, we'd only arrive at an explanation of the human being if we were able to say what share the whole universe has in configuring the brain and configuring the liver, just as the earth has a share in determining the direction of the magnetic needle. Today we are studying the aspects of the hereditary stream, let us say. We go back to the ancestors, or to the present time. We go to the descendants, doing so in the succession of animals, in the succession of human beings. Consider what we find in that way. We must, of course, have the necessary knowledge. But we are only considering whatever the immediate events tell us, considering them in their inner human aspect, as it were. We don't ask if it might not be that the fertilized ovum in the human organism is merely given opportunity to let powers from the universe influence it in all kinds of different ways. Nor do we ask if it is perhaps not altogether so that the configuration of the fertilized ovum cannot be explained if we stay inside the human being. Surely we must relate it to the whole universe. In official science, the powers influencing us from the universe are secondary. You will say, yes, but science takes us to a point today where we do not come to ask such questions. It is out of date to relate the human organs to the universe. And it is indeed something out of date, the way it is often done. The fact, however, that we are all together and on the broadest base not encouraged to ask such questions is merely due to our education in science. This is such that we are kept at the level of this merely evidence-based empirical science, as it were, and therefore never think of asking questions of the kind which I have been putting here, initially merely hypothetically, as an introduction. It really depends on raising questions, how far we get in gaining insight, and how far we progress in human activity in all areas. When no questions are asked, we are really living in a kind of scientific fog. We obscure our view of reality itself. And then it happens that we will really only see how limited our vision is when things no longer fit in with our thoughts and ideas. I do, however, think that this feeling which I am thus referring to may really be most prevalent in present-day medicine. It is the feeling that things are really going very differently in human beings than they ought to, if following the often rather straight theories. Theories, by the way, on which treatment is also based. One then gets the feeling that surely it must be possible to use some other approach to the issue. I really believe that the things which need to be said here can mean something to hardly any expert in the field, but to those who follow developments in healthy and sick individuals and see how the views generally held are too glib and never get anywhere near the complexity of things. Let's be honest for once. Let us consider how, in the whole of the 19th century, scientific and practical thinking did in all spheres always produce something like an axiom. It's enough to make one despair how this axiom-like thing is always flung at one. People would always say that explanations should be as simple as possible. And people did make their explanations as simple as possible. Well, when things and developments are complicated, it is prejudice to say that explanations should be as simple as possible. It needs an effort to go into complexities. Enormous damage has been done in this respect, I'd say, in the whole of human nature, where knowledge and practice are concerned, because people would proclaim again and again, explanations must be as simple as possible. Everywhere on the smallest scale and the largest, nature is not simple. but tremendously complex. And we can really only get anywhere near nature if we know from the start that even the seemingly most perfect views relate to reality the way photos of a tree do that are taken from one side. I can photograph the tree from many different angles. The photos may differ completely from one another. The more photos I have, the sooner will I come close to the reality of the tree in my idea of it. With regard to theories and views, the present-day opinion is that one particular theory is true. Any other theory one may have is then wrong. But that is exactly like the situation when someone photographs a tree from one side. He then has that photo. Someone else photographs the tree from a completely different angle. The first person shows him his photo and he says, "That's wrong, completely wrong. Only this one is right," meaning that his view is the right one. That is more or less how people have been in dispute over materialism, idealism, realism, and all kinds of things. The battles fought in this sphere are no different from the seemingly commonplace example I have been giving you. I would therefore ask you, from the start, not to take the things I have to say here as if they were materialistic, idealistic, or spiritualist, but merely as intended to approach reality in accord with human powers of vision. We can sometimes achieve a great deal with materialistic ideas when we want to control the real world, providing we are also prepared to marshal the opposite aspect. If we are not in a position to tell the aspects apart, well, then we get human views that are more or less like having all kinds of different photos taken on one and the same photographic plate. Many of the things put forward today do look as if photos from all kinds of different angles had been taken on one plate. Now, you see, if we make the powers which I said are latent in the soul active, using the means I discussed in my book, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, we do indeed go beyond the ordinary level of insight, pursued with special care in the most recent phase in biology, to the insight in images which I described. A further level is inspired insight, and the highest level to date, if I may use the term, is intuitive insight, truly intuitive insight. With insight in images, I get images of the reality, knowing full well that they are images. But I also know that they are not dream images, but images of the real thing. Insight in images does not give me that reality, but I have images of something real. With inspired insight, these images gain consistence, as it were. Something is alive in them. I know more, thanks to the images, than the image as such is able to give. I know from the images that they refer to a spiritual reality. And with intuitive insight, I am within this spiritual reality itself. That is the progression. You will find everything that can be said about these three kinds of insight in the book to which I have referred on several occasions. Initially, these three kinds of insights, which are beyond the insight into facts apparent to the senses, give us insights into spiritual worlds, a spiritual universe, and the spiritual human being, the human being in mind and soul. Initially, it is not insight concerning empirical research findings we have in, say, biology today, but the application of the special state of soul into which we enter with image-based insight, inspired or intuitive insight, to the study of the human being is something else. You see, we contemplate the structure of the human brain, for example. This is something worthy of note, not so much to physiologists and the medical profession, but to those who are called psychologists. Psychologists are a group apart within our civilization, for as you know, they have managed to have a science with no object. Psychology without soul, without psyche. For psychologists, the structure of the brain is worthy of note. Take a psychologist, for instance, who has actually come from wholly empirical science. People did not know how to get anywhere with philosophy in most recent times, for they could not tell if a philosopher knew something or not. It was clear that natural scientists always knew something. And so natural scientists, who also had an interest in philosophy, were given chairs of philosophy in more recent times. With natural scientists, it is a matter of course that they know something, for in philosophy you can use lots of words, but in natural science you can't be airy-fairy, saying you've seen things under the microscope or through a telescope or on an X-ray. This will be evident when checks are made. In philosophy, it is not so easy today to check if someone is being airy-fairy. Consider how Theodor Ziehen talks about the structure of the brain. Something really interesting happened to me in this respect. Maybe a story will help to make it clear. I attended a meeting once, many years ago, where a physician spoke first about the structure of the brain, explaining it in relation to the inner life, his point of view being one it would be fair to call materialistic. This out-and-out materialist explained the structure of the brain pretty well, according to the present state of knowledge, and related the inner life to the structure of the brain. The chairman at the meeting was a Herbartian, and he construed for himself not the structure of the brain, but life in ideas, as the philosopher Herbart once did. And he said that it was remarkable how a physiologist, a physician, makes a drawing of the brain, drawing figures. When I, as a Herbartian, he said, draw the complex associations of ideas, meaning just a depiction of linked ideas, not of nerve strands connecting one nerve cell with another. When I, as a real Herbartian who is not concerned with the brain, draw my ideas of the way in which ideas are linked, and so on, doing so in a wholly symbolic form, it looks very similar to the physiologist's drawing of the brain structure. The similarity has its reasons. As scientists have progressively established the structure of the brain in natural science, it became more and more evident that the external structure of the brain corresponds most beautifully to the structure of our life in ideas. Everything we find in the life of ideas may also be seen in the structure of the brain. It simply is, please take this with a grain of salt, as if nature herself deliberately made the brain a sculpted image of our life in ideas. Such things really strike one when one reads what someone like Meinert has written, for instance. It is now a little out of date. Meinert was a materialist, but an excellent brain physiologist, psychiatrist, and one would like to say, quote, yes, he is a materialist, but the things he gives us as a materialist are an excellent payment on account for the things we also discover if we don't bother with the human brain at all, but merely consider how ideas link up, separate, and so on. Merely wanting to draw these symbols, close quote. In short, if anything is liable to make us into materialists, the structure of the brain would be particularly apt to do so. We certainly have to say that if there is such a thing as mind or spirit and soul, it has found an adequate reflection in the human brain, so that we are very close to saying, quote, well, why do we need spirit and soul in order to live in ideas? If we were also to ask for a soul that is able to think, since the brain is such an accurate reflection of mind and soul, why should it not also be able to think? Close quote. You must, of course, take all these things with a grain of salt. My intention is merely to give you the meaning of this whole dispute today. The human brain can certainly make us into materialists, especially when we go into more detailed research. And the secret which governs it all, the background to it all, will only emerge when we gain the power of insight in images. For there you see images of things truly spiritual, images one has not seen before. I'd like to say, however, that those images are reminiscent of the images taking form in the human brain out of nerve cells and nerve fibers. In answer to the question as to what this insight in images, which is, of course, wholly in the supersensible sphere, really is, I'd say this. To give you symbols for this insight in images, the way a mathematician does with the symbols for mathematical problems, I might also say, imagine that we perceive more in the world than we do through the senses, by rising to images that present a reality, just as the human brain presents the reality of the human soul. In the brain, nature herself presents, as images real to the senses, something which insight in images really provides at a higher level. With this, we enter more deeply into the human constitution. In the days to come, we'll see that we always arrive at a possibility not to see this marvelous structure of the brain in isolation. But I'd say, when we see a world, a supersensible world up above, by means of vision in images, it is as if part of this world had come to realization down here, with an image-based world presenting itself to us in the human brain. In fact, I do not think that anyone can speak adequately about the human brain who does not see its structure as a presentation in images of our soul life. And it is this which takes us again and again into a dilemma when we want to get to the soul life from the physiology of the brain. For if we want to stop at the brain, we simply don't need the soul life. The only people who have the right to speak of soul life as compared to the structure of the human brain are those who know this soul life in another way as well, not only the ordinary way of this world. For when you get to know this soul life in the spiritual world, it is adequately reflected in the structure of the human brain. And anything which the supersensible organ of the soul is able to produce by way of ideas, the brain is able to produce as well. The brain is a reflection, an image, even in its functions. And no one can prove or disprove materialism on the basis of brain physiology. That simply cannot be done. If human beings were nothing but brain, one would have no need to discover that they also have a soul. Let us now turn to a function other than forming ideas. This will just be an introduction to a subject matter which I'll be presenting over the next few days. Let us turn to the breathing process. I am treating it as a function here. Call to mind the respiratory processes and human awareness of them. You will not arrive at something like life in ideas. Saying, quote, I have an idea. It reminds me of another, which I had 3 years ago. I'll link the one with the other. Close quote. You will indeed have sketches, especially if they cover a number of ideas, that are very similar to Meinert's drawings showing the structure of the brain. You will not be able to do this when you relate the nature of the breathing process to the human organism. You'll not find the same kind of adequate reflection in the structure, differentiation, or formation of the organs for the respiratory process, as you do for the process of forming ideas in the brain. This you cannot do. In the respiratory process, we have something which cannot be adequately reflected in the human organism the way our life of ideas and of sensory perception is reflected in the human organism, with a life and ideas and perceptions also adequately reflected in the structure of the brain. But when we rise to inspired insight, that is, come to perceive how, with insight in images, we first have images and then reality enters into them with inspired insight shining through them, I'd say, if we learn thus to look into the supersensible world, and the images are saturated for us with spiritual reality, then we are suddenly in something supersensible which is wholly similar to the relationship between the respiratory process, the structure of the lung, the structure of the epidural space or spinal canal, with the thrust of the breath penetrating to the brain. In short, when you advance to inspired insight, you find the principle which takes you to the whole significance of the respiratory process, just as insight in images takes you to the significance of the brain structure. You are then able to say, where the brain is insight in images brought to realization, everything connected with respiration is an inspiration brought to realization, taken down into the sense-perceptible world. All that someone who is looking for inspired insight is doing is to enter into a world, which in that case is spirit and soul, but lies before us here in the sense-perceptible world when we study the whole of the respiratory process in its significance for the organism. We thus really need insight in images to understand the structure of the brain, and inspired insight to understand the breathing rhythm and everything connected with it. Everything connected with the breathing rhythm is therefore something entirely different, relative to the universe, from the structure of the brain. The latter, I'd say, largely reflects the spiritual in its external three-dimensional form. And so we need not advance far into the supersensible world, only as far as insight in images, which comes right next to ordinary insight, and we will gain understanding of the brain structure. You won't find the respiratory process with insight in images. You need inspired insight and have to move higher up in the supersensible world. And you see, we have to go farthest in the supersensible world if we want to understand the metabolic process. Essentially, this metabolic process is the most mysterious element in the human being. We shall see in the days to come that we have to think very differently about this metabolism from the way one does today in empirical physiology based on sensory perception. The changes gone through by the physical matter placed on my tongue, to the point, let us say, where it makes something happen in my brain cell, these changes cannot be discerned with mere empirical research, but only with intuitive insight. With this, we penetrate from merely looking at the object into the object itself. And human metabolism is indeed such that compared to the element of mind and soul, which creates an image of itself in the brain, otherwise remaining outside it, influences the breathing rhythm, entering into it and filling it with spirit and soul, but always withdrawing again. The human spirit and soul enters completely into metabolism, actually vanishing into it. We won't find it again, nor will we find it empirically. Take a look at Theodor Zihin's book, how well he describes the structure of the human brain. You can indeed analyze the powers of memory so well, also symbolically, that you will be able to demonstrate matching physiological and anatomical forms in the brain. Things got awkward when Zihin came to the feelings. He, therefore, did not refer to feelings as something independent, but only to ideas with a strong feeling element. Psychologists no longer refer to the will at all today. Why? It's perfectly natural that they don't. Now, if I want to raise my arm, that is, perform an act of will, I first have the idea. Then something goes down into the sphere which is completely unconscious, in quotes, as it is said to be today. Everything that cannot be observed in the soul, but is nevertheless believed to exist, is put into this reservoir. The whole of it then goes down into this unconscious mind. I then look at the way I move my hand. But between the intention and the accomplished fact, the act of will taking place goes wholly down into the material aspect of the physical organism. Intuition allows one to follow this exactly. The will goes down into the inner nature of the organism. The act of will goes as far as metabolism. There is no act of will in physical human beings on earth which cannot, with intuitive insight, be traced to a particular metabolic process. Yet there also is no will process which is not reflected in a process of decomposition or dissolution, call it what you will, in the metabolic sphere. To be able to unfold, the will first gets something which is there somewhere in the organism out of the way. It is as if I must first burn up something in my arm when I need it to express my will. Something must first be got out of the way. In the next few days it will become evident. I know that it is utter heresy in natural science, but it will show itself to be the truth, that something must first be put out of the way. Physical substance must first be destroyed so that the will may have a place. The element of spirit and soul must occupy the place made free by destroying some physical material. That is the essential nature of intuitive insight. You will not be able to explain metabolic processes in human beings unless you look for them with intuitive insight. All the functions to be found in human beings really consist in these three: the neurosensory process, the rhythmic processes, breathing and the circulation of the blood, and the metabolic processes. The human being thus is really insight brought to realization and made physical. That is, what we see initially when looking at it from outside or investigating by dissection. Limiting ourselves to the human head, we come to realize what is really going on in the head if we know that there is such a thing as insight based on images. Looking at the rhythmic human being, what is really going on there becomes evident if we know that there is inspired insight. Looking at the metabolic processes, we realize what is going on there if we know what an intuitive insight is. The reality principles in the human being thus lie one in the other. Look at the organs, for instance, that are holy organs of the will, and only intuitive insight will make it possible to understand them. For as long as we apply the one unvarying form of gaining insight to the human being, we will not discover that this human being is in fact something different from what we ordinarily feel him to be. As you know, it is known in modern physiology that the human being is largely seen as a column of water. No need for me to tell you. But if you now consider in all honesty, if the fact that the human being is a column of water is taken into account in physiology, or if people do not, after all, think of nothing but sharply outlined solid forms in considering the human being, if you ask yourself about this, you will say, little regard is given to the fact that essentially human beings are fluid, with solid forms merely included in it. The human being is also made of gases, however air, and finally also, in the main, of warmth. Ordinary study gives me a good grasp of the solid element in the human being. Just as I get to know the nature of red mercury sulfide, cinnabar, in the laboratory, so I can get to know the nature of solids by physico-chemical investigations of the human organism. I cannot do this with regard to fluids in the human being. The fluid organization is constantly being organized and deorganized in human beings. It cannot be drawn the way I draw the stomach or the heart. If I draw these organs as if they were solid, it is, of course, easy to discuss them. But that is not how things are, when we really take this fluid organization seriously. In the fluid sphere, something is all the time developing and disappearing again. It is as if the heart were always developing and disappearing again, though not at great speed. To approach the fluid human being, we need insight based on images. As to the gaseous, aeriform part of us, We do, of course, know the great significance of the functions in the aeriform part of the organism. We know that aeriform substances in the organism move from everywhere to everywhere, and how everything is in circulation in that sphere. But when one sphere of the aeriform influences another, it does so exactly according to the pattern of inspiration. We are only able to gain an overview of the aeriform element in us if we work with inspiration. As to the sphere of warmth in the human being, try for a moment to understand that man is something quite special because human beings are warmth structures, with warmth and coldness in structure in all kinds of different places and in all kinds of different ways. You have to be right inside the way human beings live in their own warmth with their capital I. You have to enter into this with intuitive insight. If you consider the human being as a whole, not as a combination of solid, sharply outlined organs, but as a whole, you may truly say that we have to go in from different angles, driven to gain insight in images. By inspiration or intuition, we come from the brain to the other organ structures. And the same applies when we consider the different states of aggregation in the human being. You see, when you consider the solid structures, the actual solid bodies in the human being, these hardly differ from such as are found outside the human organism. But the fluid elements and the gaseous elements differ greatly, and the warmth element even more so. We will talk about this in the days to come. But the organs only gain their proper significance for our insight into the nature of the human being if we broaden our approach to the human being. Physiology that is purely based on sensory perception and empiricism barely allows you to trace the functions of the human organism beyond the progress of chyme from the intestinal villi into the lymph vessels. That is as far as you can still get in today's sensory experience-based empiricism. Beyond this, people are really fantasizing. All ideas on what then happens to the material we take in from outside, for instance, what happens in the circulating blood, are basically mere indulgence in fantasy in modern physiology. Something like the involvement of the kidneys in the human organization, for instance, can only be grasped if we consider the descending processes and not only the ascending processes, which today are almost the only ones considered important for the human constitution. A long time ago, I told a friend, considering the unfolding of the human germ from fertilization to birth is important. But it is equally important to consider the organs that lie around the germ and are later cast out. We will only get a complete picture when studying cell division if apart from this ascending process, we also follow the descending process. For we do not only have this descending process next to us, as it were, in the embryonic period, but we have it in us also in later life. We need to know for every organ in how far there are ascending processes in it, and in how far descending processes. Descending processes are, as a rule, connected with increased conscious awareness. For a clear mind, we actually need descending processes, decomposition, destruction, clearing away matter. It is the same with the eliminatory processes. The kidneys are organs of elimination. The question is, however, if in the sensory experience of empiricism they are initially organs of elimination, do they not also have significance for the human constitution? Is there not something other than this eliminatory function, something which makes the kidneys more important in building up the human being? If we trace the functions further and move, say, from the kidney to the liver, we have the following interesting phenomenon. The kidney ultimately discharges matter to the outside. The liver secretes to the inside. The question arises as to what it means for the relationship of the liver process to the kidney process, that the kidney relatively discharges its secreted products to the outside and the liver to the inside. The human being is thus communicating with the outside world in the one case and with itself in the other. This gradually guides us to full insight into the human organism. But we must, of course, make use of the insights sought along the routes I was able to refer to briefly as an introduction today. I intend to take this further in my next lecture and show how these methods lead to genuine understanding of pathology and therapy, and how far we have guiding principles for empirical research, the method recognized today, which we certainly do not want to touch in any way. We merely want to show how it is really only given its true value if we are able to establish such guidelines. I am not in the least keen to do anything against modern natural scientific research. On the contrary, I would like to show that tremendously rich resources still lie in this natural scientific medicine to provide better insight than is gained with present-day methods, and above all, from the present-day point of view. The natural scientific approach is not to be given a bad name, but rather given the right foundations. Given such a basis out of the spirit, it will gain its full significance. I'll continue with this tomorrow. The end of Lecture 5.